Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts, and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
This is going to be a slightly unstructured talk, in the sense that I'm going to talk a little bit about the experience of putting the exhibition together, as well as run through some of the works that those of you who haven't seen the show will see when you take the opportunity to go and see the show, and those of you who have seen the show, well, you may already have some, you will have seen the works, but you hopefully will gain a bit more insight to what the works are about, or at least what some of the interpretations of the works are about. I should also state from the beginning that this is quite an unusual departure for us, because unlike most of the loan exhibitions that we do here at the Royal Academy, this exhibition is one where we distinctly encourage people with digital devices and phones and cameras and so on and so forth to actually go into the exhibition and record your experiences, record the works in any way you want, and to disseminate that information. That's very clearly part of what WayWay is about as well. So this idea that we can share this knowledge or experience is very key to the exhibition. Just a little bit of background, perhaps, for those of you who don't know that much about WayWay, the man. He was born to, both of his parents are writers, but his father in particular was a very celebrated poet, Ai Ching, and you can see him here with a very young Ai Weiwei. And Weiwei was born in 1957, and within a year of his birth, there were kind of very strong moves against intellectuals, or the idea that people who demonstrated free speech and were discussing, having lively discussions about not only the culture but the political and economic situation in China, had been encouraged by the Communist Party to give full voice to those concerns and debates and discussions that they'd been having in a more public way. And the consequence of that was in 1958 and 59, there was widespread suppression of intellectuals, free-thinking individuals who were questioning perhaps some of the political strictures in place at the time. And Ai Weiwei's father, Ai Ching, was one of those intellectuals that was clamped down upon in the anti-rightist movement, it was called, and first sent to northeast China on the borders with Korea, and then more seriously to northwest China, where he spent the next 20 years in internal exile in China. So here was a man, a free-thinking intellectual, a poet, a man of great culture, a man who travelled outside of China, who moved in intellectual circles, suddenly found himself moved away from Beijing, where he lived and where Weiwei was born, and placed into a labour camp. And part of the responsibilities that he had there, in fact, main duty that he had there, was to clean public toilets. Now, I didn't know, and I'm sure some of you probably do know, but if you haven't been to Beijing or China generally, mainland China, lots of people don't actually have sewage or running water in their homes, and they actually use communal toilets, public toilets. So it's quite common, in fact, as you go through neighbourhoods in Beijing, to come across a public toilet and then, you know, not much further down the road, come across another one. So they serve a very, you know, a clear, distinct public function. But for obviously for a cultured individual to be reduced to kind of that work was a major calamity isn't quite the right word, but I mean a major kind of restriction on their freedom of thought and the freedom of movement, as well as kind of really humiliating, I suppose, would be one word of describing it. Now, Weiwei went with his father and spent the first 20 years of his life pretty much in these conditions. And at one point, they actually lived literally in a hole dug out of the ground and covered with tree branches. But he learnt a lot from his father, had huge respect for his father, and in particular was very impressed and speaks about how His father was reduced to this very menial job, low job, but that his father was determined to be the very best that he could. So his toilets, Weiwei says, were always the cleanest. So he kind of combated that situation by confronting it full on, if you like. A major influence in Weiwei's life, I think, as we will hopefully will see throughout maybe this presentation, also in the exhibition. After Chairman Mao died in 1976, the family were rehabilitated and moved back to Beijing, where there was this Beijing Spring, it was called, which was a restriction on some of the... it was a sort of restriction on freedom of education and freedom of movement. It was a short-lived thing, but it allowed Weiwei to go into the Central School of Art in Beijing, where he studied animation. And it was at this point in the late 70s, 78, that he joined this group called the Stars, which were this young group of artists who were trying to find new ways of expressing themselves through art. This had a very kind of complicated relationship with the authorities, who they weren't able to get access to museums or galleries, so they had their first exhibition literally by hanging their work on the railings outside of the National Museum in Tiananmen Square. The work was removed, there was a process of negotiation, they were given the space to show their work for 2 weeks, and so on and so forth. So it was always a slight... battle with the authorities to get their work shown and to be able to express themselves. And soon after that, beginning of 1980, 1981, the kind of censorship started coming back. And so many artists decided that time was right to leave China and to seek kind of cultural, artistic freedom elsewhere. Weiwei, like many, went to America. This is a photograph of him in New York, the Lower East Side, where he lived. And he went first to Philadelphia, where he sort of started haphazardly learning English, then moved to San Francisco, where he spent a year, again, learning English with a view to entering art school. He entered Parsons School of Design in New York in 1983, and he spent the next 10 years living in New York. So I think what's really interesting about Weiwei is he has this very, very tough kind of upbringing, no frills, no luxuries, very basic kind of existence. He then experienced this kind of sprouting of artistic cultural expression in China, which was then trampled down, and then went to America. And of course, what we probably tend to overlook is at that time, artists, budding artists in China, had no access to the kind of libraries and facilities that we do. So they had no access to books about the history of Western art, for example, virtually none whatsoever. So moving to America was in a way like seeing the world anew and having the ability to see exhibitions, to travel to museum collections and see things in a very different way. But throughout his time, he was still a kind of budding artist. He hadn't much success. He had a show in New York at a gallery there, but he didn't sell anything in that show. He basically made his money by doing odd jobs, working in restaurants, working as a portrait artist in Times Square, and perhaps most successfully, going to Atlantic City and playing cards. He's a demon card player, so if you ever get the invitation to play cards with him, I'd think twice. So he stayed in New York, and he had, by that point, had encountered Marcel Duchamp and was very influenced by the notion of the ready-made, taking often industrially made products or objects and transforming them into art objects, something that he experimented with a lot at that time. And something I think that has kind of continued throughout his work, this notion of taking something that pre-exists and reformulating it. So, in 1993, he returned to China. His father, by that point, was actually quite ill, and I think he saw that as a kind of excuse, a reason to go back, because he had, at that point, no real intentions of going back to China, but he decided that it was a good moment to justify going back. So he went back, and he's been there ever since. And this exhibition really starts in 1993 or 1994, and is really pretty much an exhibition that examines the last 22 years of work that he's produced in China over that period. So a little bit of, this is the layout of the exhibition for those of you who haven't been round. This is actually something that we've produced specially for the exhibition, so it's part of, many of you will be familiar with our kind of gallery guides you get when you purchase your ticket. This is a gallery guide with a bit of a difference because it folds out to give you a kind of map of the exhibition and a kind of logic to how the exhibition works. But of course, people are free to kind of move around the galleries as they choose. And I suppose it would be quite, at this point, it might be quite a good idea just to give you a bit of the story about the preparation of the exhibition and how it came about. And I think really what's quite interesting and moving in many ways was the fact that the last major, well, the last show, exhibition that Wei Wei worked on outside of China, in which he was able to attend, was actually the sunflower seed installation at Tate Modern in 2010, which I'm sort of sure many of you will have visited and seen. Some of you may have even picked up some seeds and have them at home somewhere. I know plenty of people did. There were 100 million of them after all. And it was, in fact, after he returned to China following that experience that the situation began to deteriorate for him in terms of his relationship with the authorities and his free movement. So it's rather fitting and completely coincidental for us that the first exhibition that he was able to witness or experience and help install after his passport was returned to him in July this year was back in London, and hit this time at the Royal Academy. And he, despite being an honorary Royal Academician, this is those artists and architects that are not born in the UK can have this title of being an honorary member of the Academy. Wei Wei had never actually been inside the building. When he was here for the Tate installation, he did actually venture into the courtyard, but we discovered after initial conversations with him that he'd never actually stepped inside the building and had no idea what the galleries looked like or the type of exhibitions really that we did. So we had to think on our feet a little bit about how to work with him on this project, because obviously he was not allowed to leave China. He was free to move around mainland China, but well, relatively free, that is, but not actually to leave the country. So the first thing that I thought would be quite useful and quite easy to do in many ways would be to shoot a film of the galleries. And at that point, we had Anson Kiefer on. And I started the tour actually on Piccadilly so that he would have a sense of coming through the archway off Piccadilly into the courtyard, moving through the courtyard, which of course at that point had that installation by Kiefer, the big aquariums, and then moving up the main stairs into the vestibule where the shop is and the entrance to the exhibition, and then working sequentially around the galleries, and in each case pointing out details such as the height at which we can paint the walls, the type of ceilings we have, the weight restrictions we have in certain places, and also the kind of floor grill, all those kind of details like that. And so we sent that off to him with some plans, and at that point I don't think we'd actually even met him. But Tim Marlowe, who is artistic director at the Royal Academy and co-curator of the show, along with Wei Wei himself and myself and me, went out to visit him the first time, and I put together this big package of kind of ideas that we'd had about what we could do with the space. I mean, it was a hugely ambitious document, far too many works, much more than we could accommodate, but the kind of sense was that we wanted to be ambitious with the space and we wanted to include a lot of the big works as much as possible in the spaces we have. Out of that came a distilled version. Wei Wei took his time to look through it, and at that point it was Wei Wei's decision to basically omit works prior to his return, with the exception of one piece, to omit all the early works that he made in New York. the sort of ready-made works, as they've become known. And he'd come up with a plan, an idea, which we then refined. And it was that process of refining the idea that came up with the plan that you see behind me here. And it was a remarkably, I mean, let me tell you, it was a remarkably straightforward process. We sent him the dossier of works in September last year. This was, I mean, the agreement to do the show only happened in September last year. And by November, when I made my first visit to the studio and sat down with Weiwei, we laid out the exhibition and it hadn't really changed since. So that was kind of revelatory in itself. And part of that is his incredible ability to... of course, he had the film of the galleries, but that's, you know, a 10-minute, 15-minute kind of fly-through, really, in some ways. But his ability to kind of see space, configure space, and fill the galleries with his work was kind of quite awesome to witness. And the confidence he had in the layout of the exhibition and the choice of materials. We did a bit of horse trading early on about some of the works, but essentially the concept of the show didn't change at all, which I think is pretty remarkable. I've worked with other artists and often there is some quite late minute changes and anxieties about what the galleries can and can't do and what the exhibition is about, but not so with Weiwei. So he's a man who's very confident about his art and confident about what he's trying to tell through his art. I think that's kind of quite interesting in itself. And so the exhibition really starts, and I've only got a few works up on the slideshow that I thought we could talk about in a little bit more detail. But in essence, the show starts in Gallery 1. Thankfully, we call it Gallery 1 as well. In fact, the numbers of the galleries don't really change. We refer to all these galleries with these numbers, except for Gallery 10 and number 11. Gallery 10 is known as the lecture room, and Gallery 11 is the central hall. But the exhibition opens, in fact, I do think I have an image of this work, with this work called Bed, which dates from 2004. And it's actually only the second time it's ever been shown. It was shown once in Switzerland in Bern in an exhibition there. And it's a little hard to see from this photograph, and I'm sure those of you who've been into the galleries will kind of know the shape and form it takes. It is pretty substantial, and it sort of fills most of the central space of the gallery and is actually a map of China. Some of you may know that he does lots of work with maps, in particular maps of China, some of which are more overtly political than others. He did a map in milk baby formula cans, which was shown in Hong Kong, which was a commentary on the poisoning, the melanine poisoning that lots of children suffered from during the year of the Olympics in 2008. But this is an early work, and I think it's a rather fantastic way to start the exhibition, I have to say so. I think his choice here was kind of inspired. We hummed and hawed about which of the map works to put in this space, and we agreed on this one, partly because of what happens in Gallery 3, which I'll show you in a moment. But what this is made of is a selection of recycled or reclaimed wood, tieli wood, which is a hardwood. It's actually called ironwood, and is a material that is historically associated with the great building kind of boom in the Qing Dynasty. Qing Dynasty is 1644 to 1911, quite a long dynasty, but it was a time when Beijing increased in size, or Peking as it then was. And this wood is incredibly durable and has stood the test of time, and was, until relatively recently, used for building of palaces and temples in particular, so top-end kind of buildings. It's now a material that can be bought as salvage by weight. You pay for it not by the quality of the object itself, but by the weight of it. And what Weiwei has done is taken these timbers and reformulated them, reconfigured them in many different ways, as we'll see as we go through the slide presentation. But in this case, he's created this map of China, which, if you can imagine the outline, the geopolitical borders of China as you would see them in an atlas. They're represented by all these sort of rises and falls, kind of contours, if you like, of the map. And if you could imagine the map, if you could imagine taking which is cutting one part of that map and then just opening it up and laying it flat like a mattress, this is what he's done. So he's kind of just taken the country, so from it being a rough round shape, he's just made it flat. And not only has he done that, but more recently this year, in fact, or last year, this year and last, he's made this work, which is called, it's an untitled work, which is 44 of these roundels. And these equate, this is a slightly kind of complex idea. It took me a little while to grasp it myself. But if you can imagine this being sliced across here 44 times, like you would slice a cake, just lengthwise, each section of that is then bent round on itself to create a very distinct shape. And each one of the 44 has its own contours. So the contours of that map are translated into the contours of that map. And then there's a blank space. They just occupy the wall. So I think from the outset, Wei Wei is laying down a marker saying that this exhibition is about the time that he's been in China. It's very much about him being a Chinese artist, and it's very much about Chinese heritage, culture, and history, and expressions of or comments on Chinese society today. So the reason that all these timbers are available is the fact that those of you who've been to Beijing will know, I myself was pretty surprised when I saw it the first time. It's an incredibly modern city, much less historic fabric than I anticipated. In fact, very little historic fabric has been left. And by that, we have the Forbidden City, which is a gigantic kind of piece of heritage in the center of the city, opposite Tiananmen Square. And then there are one or two of the traditional districts known as hutongs, which are these kind of like narrow alleyways. If you can imagine, slightly almost like medieval streets, very narrow, with these low-rise buildings on either side. And these buildings are basically inward-facing courtyard-based houses. So that was a very typical residential kind of feature. Wei Wei himself was born in one of those hutongs and lived in one of those hutongs when he was going to art school in Beijing. Those neighborhoods, large numbers of those have been demolished, and the palaces and temples sited within them to make way for the modernization of Beijing and the kind of race for industrial strength and global dominance. And the kind of interest or support of heritage has been a price that they've paid in pursuit of that economic gain. And this is something that has kind of not only just affected Wei Wei, but it's something that he references a lot by reusing these materials. So this is a very noble material. It's been around for 300-400 years. It stood the test of time, yet it still kind of has been removed to allow for this process to take place. So I think one of the things that's really interesting about Wei Wei is there are often these layers or and kind of connections in his work that are not immediately obvious when you look at them. Despite the kind of aesthetic appeal and the quality of the craftsmanship, if you do, or when you do go into the galleries, do take a look down the side here, and you'll see the unbelievable quality of the joins that have been made to create this work, all the different pieces of wood and how they've been configured to hold this shape. So moving from bed, so we see we're talking about China, we're talking about events that have influenced both Wei Wei and China more widely. I think the kind of key work and the key gallery within the exhibition is Gallery 3, our largest gallery, which is dominated by a work we're about to see in a moment, and the content of this entire gallery revolves around the earthquake in Sichuan in 2008. This was an earthquake that happened in the middle of the morning in May, and with devastating consequences, massive destruction of buildings, somewhere between 70,000 to 90,000 people killed. And Wei Wei, at this point, didn't really kind of know why, but he was drawn to go up to the region, where he was able to witness scenes of the destruction himself. These are four of the 16, I think, photographs in the exhibition. And you'll see here this sea of backpacks. And this is particularly poignant, I think. I mean, obviously, the destruction is very noticeable and extraordinary in its kind of scale. But what Wei Wei really responded to, and it's something that he's used in his work further on, is also the high death toll amongst school children. At this time of the day, children were at school, and over 5,000 were killed in the state-built schools when the buildings just collapsed, basically, on top of them. And many parents never saw their children again. Authorities were quick to kind of move in and start the cleanup process, but there was no real interest in identifying the names of the victims. So Wei Wei, with others, set up what they called a citizens' investigation and started systematically trying to give names to... They decided to focus on the children, so they decided to systematically establish the names, sex, age... of the children that had suffered in the earthquake. They're very quite harrowing scenes, and there's a video in the exhibition. It was a very torturous process. The authorities did not support Wei Wei and his fellow investigators in this endeavor. In fact, they tried to block them, they arrested people, they beat people up. They did everything they could to prevent this investigation from going on. Wei Wei himself was beaten up and prevented from testifying in a court case, and 2 weeks later, when he went to Munich, suffered a brain hemorrhage as a consequence of the beating, and was, had emergency surgery. Indeed, in fact, the first thing he did after he got his passport back was to go and see his doctor in Munich, and to have a full health check, make sure that he was okay. They started the citizens' investigation. You can't really see it in this, but this is a list of names. There are columns running down, and there are nearly 5,200 names of children that they were able to identify. And there are others that they know they'll never will be able to identify. But they made a pretty kind of laudable effort at gathering this information and publicising it. At this point, Wei Wei had kind of discovered the internet, and from being a kind of technophobe, he became a kind of techno, techno whiz, geek, whatever, really into, and he started blogging, and his blogs are very outspoken, and there is a book actually which has a number of those blogs in it, but very outspoken critic of the whole situation. And so this name list, you'll see it flanks both sides of the galleries. It's a pretty sobering document in itself. And this really is when he started having tremendous problems with the authorities in China for his outspoken statements and views. Not only Wei Wei, of course, there are others as well. But the key work to come out of this is a work called Straight. You'll see it here. It is a work that's taken 4 years to make, and it is comprised of steel rebar. So steel rebar, for those of you who don't know, is the steel rods that people use in the construction of reinforced concrete. And you'll see a lot of it probably in London when they lay out these grids and kind of attach all the rods together to form a kind of grid of which they then pour the concrete over. Or pillars as well. The rebar that Wei Wei has used here is not just rebar that he's gone down to a builder's yard and collected and purchased. This was rebar that came from the scenes that we witnessed earlier from the detritus of the buildings that collapsed. So he bought 200 tons of twisted, mangled rebar that had been, as is often the case with construction, you'll probably notice that they separate out the concrete, which is taken to be pulverized, and the steel is taken to be recycled. So he bought 200 tons of this steel that was destined to be recycled, and took it to his studio in Beijing, and didn't really know what to do with it, but he felt that, you know, he wanted to use a material that was visceral to the kind of to that earthquake, something that had come out of that earthquake. And so what he had was this huge pile of, and he still has some of it actually in his studio, and 150 tons of that was straightened out by hand by individuals over this four-year period. We unfortunately don't have 150 tons in the gallery. In fact, it's never been shown in its entirety, but we do have 96 tons, which is a first for us. We don't think we've ever had an installation of that magnitude in the galleries. And you can see here it is alongside the name list. These are photos of our galleries. And it's a rather significant work, I think, because not only does it contain material that was taken from the buildings themselves, but also a constant kind of reminder, if you like, of the accusations that were thrown about the standards of building that had been applied. And there was widespread belief that the local authorities had cut back on the materials they used for the buildings, which obviously, when it came to the earthquake, meant that they collapsed quicker and more readily than they would have done if they'd been built properly. And the complaint is, the accusation is, that this was done for personal profit, so that they cut back on the spending of the building materials so that they could profit from it economically. So a lot of the buildings actually didn't have any reinforced concrete at all. So we have this kind of, in a way, unforgivable cost-cutting and yet unforgettable kind of memorial to the very material itself. And furthermore, it has these incredible undulations which sort of make you feel like the plates that the moved in the earthquake, the actual movement of the earth is captured in the work itself. I think it's an unbelievably powerful and somber memorial to the people that died in that earthquake. And again, one of the things that Weiwei and I talked about was the visual connection between this and bed. Very similar kind of form when you look at it through this from the side. So a nice kind of connection in that respect. So you can see it here. So we'll move on to a story that is less about the impact across a much broader section of the population in China to something that's much more personal to Weiwei himself. And these crabs are rather fun, aren't they? 3,000 porcelain crabs. And I couldn't resist putting that. That was, they came out of their boxes from China, and they art handlers and technicians laid them all out on the table, 3,000 of these little critters. And I thought they looked rather fantastic, lined up like that, with their beady eyes focused. They're different types. You can see these ones have their little feet and claws extended. These are all bunched up, and they're red, so they've been cooked. The raw and the cooked. It's Levi Strauss, isn't it? The point of the crabs is basically to do with this work here, which is called Souvenir from Shanghai. This is a 17.5 tons of building material that has a story attached to it. And the story is basically that in 1999, Weiwei built a studio complex. He designed it. It was his first architectural plan and design. He designed it and had it built in what was then an outlying village from Beijing called Kaochengdi, where he still lives and works. And this single act inspired lots of other galleries and artists to move to that neighborhood. And so a number of galleries and studios sprang up. And it was widely credited to that Weiwei sort of sparked this interest in this area, taking it slightly out of the city, cheaper land, more affordable land, more freedom perhaps. And the authorities in Shanghai saw this and thought, well, this is a very good opportunity for us to do something similar. So they invited Weiwei in 2008 at this point, remember, he was involved with the Bird's Nest Stadium. He was the sort of darling in some ways, not quite darling, but kind of in a funny sort of way, followed a similar path to his father. His father was a close friend of Chairman Mao's and then fell foul of him. Weiwei was in a way well positioned and then fell foul of the authorities too. They invited him, not only did they invite him, but they also offered to pay for the construction of a new studio space in a part of Shanghai called Malu Town. So Weiwei agreed, designed, and then built a studio. And at this point, there was this kind of overlap with his activities around the earthquake. And the central authorities in Beijing were getting increasingly anxious about his outspoken views. They shut his blog down. And then they decided that they didn't want to promote him in any shape or form. And until, I think, this year, his name didn't exist in terms of press, in terms of internet, anything like that. He sort of disappeared as an individual in China. And the authorities rescinded this agreement and declared that they were going to demolish this studio. I haven't got images of the studio here, but you'll see them in the exhibition. And to cut a long story short, there was very little that they could do about this. Weiwei decided to commemorate his building by putting out an invitation on the web for people to come and have lunch or have a party at the studio before it was demolished. And some 2,000 people responded, at which point the authorities then put him under house arrest, so he couldn't actually attend the party. But the party went ahead, and the reason for the crabs is that that was the delicacy that was served at the table for that party. And is a homonym. The word for river crab is very similar to the word for harmonious, which is a word much used in government propaganda, but has also become an internet slang term for censorship as well. So again, more meanings. And again, this choice of material, porcelain being, of course, something associated with China historically. They've been producing porcelain for over 2,000 years. Weiwei being Weiwei didn't let sleeping dogs lie. He managed somehow to collect at least one truck full of material from the demolished studio, so parts of the concrete pillars and structure and bricks, which he then took and then built. This is actually a bed frame, so it's a four-poster bed, Qing Dynasty bed, and the bed does sit within this entire structure. So when you see it from both sides, you'll see the front and the back of the bed, but the rest of the bed is in there. And around it is built this structure. And of course, because it's a fairly organic work, it's never the same twice. So what you see here is not what you'll see when it's shown elsewhere. But what I really like about Weiwei is his ability to kind of take something and commemorate that event. So actually, he gives it even more exposure and gives it a much longer lifespan than if it had just simply, if he'd been allowed to keep his studio, no one would have been any the wiser or no one would have paid much attention to it, I'm sure. But so he's that kind of constant one step ahead, which I'm sure annoys the hell out of the authorities. The other thing that we've done with the exhibition, sorry, I'm going to rattle along a bit now because I'm speaking too much as always, is look at different materials. So there's a wood, there's a room that looks at wood, there's a room that looks at ceramics, of course, for which he's very well known, perhaps best known. This is an early work in which he takes a Han Dynasty urn and drops it. The three shots here, they actually had to take this sequence twice, so he actually dropped two pots to capture this work. You'll see his face is expressionless. There's a kind of statement, I think, in many ways about the destruction that took place in the Cultural Revolution when particularly objects of religious significance were deliberately broken and destroyed by the authorities. And coloured pots, which he's very well known, again, taking Han Dynasty urns and Neolithic urns and reconfiguring them, reworking them, and in so doing that, asking us to kind of, I suppose, reappraise value of objects and the historical and economic value of objects, and at the same time, I think, teasing us about whether these works really are authentic or not. A work that I particularly like, which I encouraged him to include in the show, is this work called Dust to Dust, which is these 30 glass jars, big. I mean, you know, it's not little, they're big jars, in this frame. And these contain the dust or powder gathered from ground up Neolithic vases, so we're told. I'm sure they are. But there's always that little bit of doubt. You never know quite what you're going to get. But what I like about them is the sense that you have that kind of connection to traditional Chinese medicine when you go into an apothecary's and they have these jars and drawers full of objects and substances. And quite often these are ground into powders. I suppose rhino horn would be an obvious, if rather disagreeable, kind of example of how an object has its intrinsic value, but when it's ground down into powder, it has this incredible power associated with it. So it's like reducing it from its real form into another gives it an enhanced kind of potency. And I think that's what I like about this work, is the kind of, what is this, you know, what is the intensity of this powder really about? We wanted very much to have a major kind of installation work in the galleries. We can safely say that we've achieved that, I think, on a number of levels. This is an interesting work. It's called Fragments, and again, you can see this kind of use of timbers from... These actually were drawn from four different temples that have been dismantled and integrated into this are these Qing Dynasty chairs and table. And it's a rather sort of organic, rather skeletal form. It's in some ways quite, when you see it, you kind of think, well, how on earth did they figure out how they were going to make this work and how it all fits together? It's a kind of intriguing thing. And you walk through it and you don't really know, is it just a kind of form that you're supposed to enjoy? But actually, I think what's telling about this work is if you were able to look at it from above, you'd see that this is a map of China. And I really like this notion that we are free to enter at any point. We're free to walk around, to circulate any which way we want to. But that's not something that is available to you when you actually go to China. I mean, obviously, there are certain parts of China that are free for us to move around, but if you wanted to go to the Uyghur region in the northwest, or if you wanted to go to Tibet, you wouldn't be allowed to do that. You have to have special visas and permission to do that. You can't just jump on a bus or a plane and go there. And imagine if it's complicated for us, how complicated it is for Chinese citizens too. So he gives us a freedom of movement within his own country that many people are denied. And I like the way that it's been created. It has no screws, no glue, no nails. It's all held together by these traditional joints. These are pieces of wood that are driven through the joints to hold it together and relate rather wonderfully, I think, to the courtyard piece, which I'm sure you all saw as you came into the academy. These eight trees. It's the largest group of trees that he's ever produced. There's the marble armchair for those of you who need to have a little break. Not very comfortable, but you can sit in it. But what I like about these trees, again, is this going link to fragments, the sense that they are slightly artificially created. They are made from bits of wood that he's collected in markets. The trees that have died naturally and the pieces are sold in the markets of southern China, and they come from the mountains. And he's bought different bits and then imagined what the tree would have originally looked like and had them created from those different parts. And they're held together by hidden joints and then these nuts and bolts. And you get this sense of the organic again, but you also, I think, like Fragments, you get the sense of a country that is kind of artificially held together. This idea of the one nation in which all of China is held together, the different ethnographic, ecological zones. Many of those ethnographic groups, of course, fighting for independence and freedom. So it's in many ways, I think, a commentary on the kind of artificial construction of what is modern-day China. We have a marble room, rather wonderful marble room, with these individual pieces of grass that are actually carved by hand. Start out with a block, then you make the form of the base, and then you start working your way down until you get your three strands of grass at the end. Grass is again a multi-layered word in Chinese. It can mean the F word. It can refer to grassroots or the kind of popular uprisings of individuals, but it can also, I think, refer to the sense that when times are good, grass flourishes, when the weather's right and the balance of rain and sun is good. But when the times are hard and the sun is baking and there's no rain, it has that appearance of being dead but can spring back to life. And I think also, of course, you know, rice is part of the grass family and a staple of Chinese food. So a wonderful room, I think, a wonderful room demonstrating kind of Wei Wei's interest in material. Now, marble is a material that's associated with the Qing dynasty in particular, the Ming dynasty, so preceding the Qing dynasty. And the quarry that Wei Wei gets his marble from is the same quarry that was used for the Ming tombs and also for construction of Forbidden City, so an imperial material. Rich material, always associated with wealth and power and authority. And it's also the same quarry that has supplied the mausoleum for Chairman Mao's mausoleum in Tiananmen Square. So again, you know, his connection, his very clearly wants to use that material because of where it comes from and what it represents. I've got another 3 minutes before we're going to open up for questions. So another map of China, made from porcelain this time, emblazoned on one side, free speech in Chinese, on the other, and in English. And it's called a puzzle, free speech puzzle. So each part represents a different province, Hainan, Taiwan. We have some bones. He was brought some, people visit him all the time in Beijing for various reasons, whether to sell him things, whether to bring him things. People bring him delicacies. When we were there, someone brought him a smoked duck. People bring him gifts. People come to see him. People come to talk to him. People come to ask him, like we did, to do exhibitions and so on. Someone brought some bones that had been clandestinely excavated from one of the former labor camps in northwest China. He's had these made in porcelain, and in many ways they're a very kind of quiet, underspoken memorial to all those intellectuals that either lost their lives or had their freedom severely curtailed during that period in recent Chinese history. The Faden Book of Art, you'll notice in the English language edition, the work that he did for Castle at Documenta is on page 8, opposite Joseph Alba's. In the Chinese language edition, he's been replaced by Agostino De Duccio, an Italian Renaissance sculptor. So the reach of the state is quite interesting, how they can reach out and actually change a major publication or influence a major publication. Sacred, this six-part work, which kind of commemorates the 81 days he spent illegally detained, secretly detained. No one knew where he was. No one knew whether they would ever see him again. He was arrested at Beijing International Airport on his way to Taiwan via Hong Kong and disappeared and only reappeared 81 days later. He was kept in a small room, which you just where this man's head. This is where it was shown in Venice, by the way, in a church. There was a little ventilator, so there was no natural light, but a little ventilator spinning around, humming all the time. He was kept inside, light on 24 hours a day. And everything he did, he's done six scenes inside these dioramas. This one, he's being interrogated, he's handcuffed to the chair. But all the time he was in this space, he was never more than 80 centimeters away from two guards, who stood over him, didn't communicate with him, they were not allowed to talk to him, but just stood next to him and watched everything he did, and everything was strictly regimented as well. He wasn't even allowed to turn over in his sleep. This is obviously a kind of form of torture deliberately aimed at breaking his spirit and encouraging him to desist from the kind of outspoken comments he's made about the authorities. He's pretty resilient, Wei Wei. He's a very strong man, and you know, given what he's been through in his life, it's not really that surprising. But he didn't buckle. What he did do was memorize the space and then commemorate it again, like he did with Souvenir from Shanghai. He's commemorated it in a way that will forever record this experience and will forever shame the authorities. The final work in the exhibition is this rather wonderful chandelier that he made specially for us in the central hall. It's the first time that he's ever combined two of his interests, which are chandeliers and bicycles, and created a bicycle chandelier. The name tells you everything you need to know. But the chandelier component is something that he's explored. He had one at Tate Liverpool in 2007, which was based on Tatlin's Tower. But what he's always done is he's used the same crystals to make these that were used in the chandeliers that adorn the Great Hall in Tiananmen Square, which is the official Communist Party meeting space. So again, a little step back and kind of sourcing materials very carefully, very considerately, and creating this wonderful object. And I suppose for us, the greatest thrill, other than doing this exhibition with him, was that he could be here with us, and he could lark around in the galleries, as you can see here. But it was a total surprise that he was going to be able to join us, and he spent, I think, 9 days or so in London. We had a wonderful time with him. And I think the exhibition was always intended, really, for us to move away, not to negate, not to deny, but certainly to engage with his political views. That's very fundamental to what he does. You can't really separate the work that he does from its content. But the key thing for us was to give people a glimpse of the artist that lies behind the dissident. He's well known as an outspoken critic, but very few people really, surprisingly, kind of know what it is he does with his art. And hopefully we've opened a little bit of a window onto that. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.